Now it's time for Toker Talk Radio, the voice of the marijuana nation.
What are you people? On dope?
Where you can toke.
I inhale.
Or you can talk.
I experimented with marijuana and didn't inhale.
Or you can toke and talk.
10 federal criminal penalties for possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
While we talk about toke on Toker Talk Radio.
So by the way, when it comes to pot, you know, if you're 40 years old, you live in a log cabin in Oregon, you got 12 giant pot plants in your backyard, have a ball.
Live from beautiful Portland, Oregon at Rolla J Studios.
Cannabis.
Plus your calls live at 971-533-7111.
They're walking on their pants with their cap on backwards, listening to Enema Man and Snoopy Snoopy Poop Dog.
What's to keep somebody from getting all potted up on weed and then getting behind the wheel?
Gateway theory doesn't work. It's a reality.
Holland, is it real? Don't tease me.
We're locking up people that take a couple of puffs of marijuana, and the next thing you know, they got 10 years.
And now, here's your host, the guru of ganja graphics, the sultan of sativa statistics, and the worst nightmare of a reefer mad prohibitionist. A polite, perspicacious, productive pothead with a propensity for PowerPoint. Radical Russ Belville.
All right, welcome back, Tokers and Tokettes. Radical Russ here. Coming to you live from beautiful legal Potland, Oregon. It's the weekend. It's the Memorial Day weekend, even. And, of course, that means that we've got a federal holiday. So there will be no show on Monday. No show on Monday, as it is Memorial Day, and we'll be taking that day off. So no cannabis Q&A with Dr. Mitch either. That's right. We'll have to take that day off because it is Memorial Day. I'll be making my way to Phoenix, Arizona. Actually, I'll be in Scottsdale, but what's the difference, right? I'll be in Scottsdale for a Tuesday show. And on Tuesday's show, our guest is going to be Becca Williams, and she's the host of a television show called Marijuana Straight Talk that's doing really great on the alternative TV, the Roku, I guess it is. So we'll talk to Becca on Tuesday. And then there'll be no show on Wednesday, because on Wednesday I'll be flying to Aspen for the Aspen Legal Seminar. And then we'll bring you shows on Thursday and Friday from Aspen. Saturday I'll be at Hunter Thompson's place at a jam session. And then we'll bring you the highlights of that on Monday. I'm just laughing because I can imagine some of you out there going, "Oh, going to Hunter Thompson's place, you bastard." Yes, I know. It'll be like my fifth time, I think, at Hunter's. Fourth or fifth, I think, at Hunter's place. And no, it's the fifth time. The fourth time I'll be going with my bass to jam. So it's going to be a good time. And I'll bring you a lot of photos and a lot of highlights from that. We'll interview a lot of great folks up there. So also, while I was here in Portland, it's weird. I'm only here for 3 days. And I got a call from Kyle Eboshi, investigative reporter with the NBC affiliate here in Portland, Oregon. Now, I had last spoken with Eboshi as far as the Burnside Burn last year, last July, when we packed the Burnside Bridge. And maybe I've talked to him since then. No, I have talked to him since then on some other story. I can't remember what it was. But it just so happened I'm in town, and it just so happened he was working on a story. So I got a chance to speak with him this morning for a story that should be out in the Portland media next week. It's embargoed, so I can't tell you much about it. I will tell you it has to do with, you know, it still being federally illegal. And, you know, we talked a lot about that and how, you know, I let him know how I think that the federal prohibition is pretty untenable at this point. And how, you know, I was just in Washington, D.C., and check out my High Times column today, by the way, hightimes.com, entitled Weed Winning in Washington, D.C., because I really think we are. I mean, just this week, we've had the House and the Senate pass the appropriations bill that allows the VA doctors to be able to discuss medical marijuana with their patients in the medical marijuana states. We've had the state of Ohio move forward on passing, you know, legislative medical marijuana that does allow access to whole plant. We're actually making some progress again in medical marijuana states. And we had, of course, the news that we broke of Congressman Rohrabacher, a GOP congressman, becoming the first in the current Congress and in the past 30 years to admit to using a medical marijuana product. And an update on that story, by the way, right? Because everybody made hay about Rohrabacher admitting that he used a medical cannabis product, and that's federally illegal. Turns out that Rohrabacher, I read this in the Orange County Register today, turns out that Rohrabacher also does not have a California doctor's recommendation. So he was breaking California law as well. So when you got Republicans admitting that they're breaking state and federal laws, the time that we can take those laws seriously is beginning to fade. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about that, the end of federal prohibition, when we return.
This is the Russ Belville Show on CannabisRadio.com.
We don't limit how much you smoke, and we don't limit where you listen. Cannabis Radio is now on iTunes, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio.
Hurry, its temperature is shooting past 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. It's burning up.
I'm afraid for this little guy, it's just too late.
What caused the problem?
Only Dr. Dabber can maintain the perfect temperature for a smooth-tasting, slower burn. This standard vaporizer lost all of its health benefits, sending it up in smoke.
So you're telling me that most vapor pens burn so hot they produce smoke, not vapor?
Correct. Keep away from those standard vaporizer pens and turn to Dr. Dabber. Doctor's orders.
Less heat? More flavor.
It's time to Hemp Presents.
I am going to titillate your audio orifices with weekly radio rendezvous with some of the premier movers, shakers, and history makers of the cannabis community.
Radio resident Hempo Sapien Vivian McPeak.
I will be putting out a call to action on issues of the day and putting your interests under the big lights as I provide cannabis commentary and weekly interviews that go straight for the nugular.
Marijuana!
Hemp Presents, only on Cannabis Radio.
Get the latest updates on the Russ Belville Show by following Radical Russ on Twitter and liking the Russ Belville Show on Facebook.
Are you playing an acoustic guitar but want to be louder without an amp? Try a resonator guitar. The fingerboard extension has National Resophonic and other resonators, square necks and round necks. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension, downtown Corvallis at 120 Northwest 2nd Street today, or check out its inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com. Go wild hog in the woods.
Most of us pirates, we go on vacation to North Dakota, you know, because they've got a town called Argusville. What are you smoking there, boy?
This is Dan Michaels from danmichaelsaudio.com, and you're listening to Radical Russ on cannabisradio.com.
Welcome back, everyone. Just about 9 after the hour, and we were discussing the end of federal marijuana prohibition. What are the chances that this could happen? Trying to read the crystal ball on this is a little bit difficult when we're in the middle of a presidential election season. Because in a regular scenario, in a real world kind of prediction, I would say that marijuana legalization is pretty much going to happen. That with 2016, we're going to have at least 3 more legal states that pass. I'll put my money on California and Nevada and Maine, I think for sure, can pass their legalization. Arizona, I don't know. That's I'd like to see Arizona pass it, considering that I have a lot of work in Arizona. But, I don't know. They barely passed medical marijuana. And Massachusetts is looking like a wobbler now. I mean, they've got 46% for, 43% against. That's a lot of undecided still. And a lot of their top, people in the state, the governor, the mayor of Boston, a bunch of police chiefs and stuff, lining up some pretty visible opposition to it. But I think we can at least get 3. Oh, and Michigan, doggone it, Michigan.
they were already scraping to possibly make the ballot in Michigan before the Michigan court or the Michigan bill went in about the 180 days. That just got dropped on them. It's a complex thing, but basically the way it works is this. When you collect signatures in Michigan, you have 180 days to collect signatures. And the way that it was that any signature you collect within 180 days, so long as it was a valid signature, was a valid signature. But after, if it was older than 180 days, you had to go and prove that it was still a valid signature. Okay? So, like, if it was 190 days old, this signature, the theory was, well, they might have moved since then. It might not be the right precinct. They might not be a registered voter anymore, et cetera, right? But you at the campaign, you can still go prove it. Now, it's a laborious process, mostly involving, you know, going to clerks and looking at paper records. But there's also electronic records in places in Michigan. And the activists that were fighting for, hey, could we have better access to these electronic records? Because then we could more easily prove that some of these older, you know, so-called spoiled signatures, you know, later than 180 days, we could rescue some of those signatures. And so the Michigan legislature said, no, we're going to fix that. We're going to make it so it has to be 180 days. You can't go back and look it up. Or if you do, if you want to go prove it, you have to go to the offices and look it up by paper, which is, you know, prohibitively expensive for how many votes you could possibly flip or signatures you could possibly gain, I should say. So once again, we see our elected officials trying to make democracy harder. And that, this is something that's just kind of happening all over the country in all sorts of issues. That is really frustrating. And it's this continued move to try to disenfranchise people, especially, you know, African Americans, liberal leaning voters, the young. Things like making it so the people who, I think Michael Moore was talking about this on TV the other day, about how the kids that go to school at the University of Michigan can't vote from University of Michigan. They have to go vote back in their home district, wherever that might be. Some of these kids are out of state. Students, some of them have to travel hundreds of miles, as Michigan's a big state, to get back home to be able to vote. Why do we keep making it harder for people to vote? We should, it's like the default should be make it easy to vote. Shouldn't it be? Even in a, like George Carlin once said, even in a fake democracy, shouldn't we get what we want some of the time? I mean, this continued disenfranchisement and making it more and more difficult for people to vote. Now, Oregon's gone the other direction. I believe Kate Brown, our governor, signed that motor voter thing where if you register your, you know, get your driver's license, you automatically register to vote, I think is the deal. And of course, we do all our voting by mail, which helps voter participation a lot because we send out a guide, a big, you know, 60, 70 page guide for the voters. You have time to look over all the candidates. I mean, how many times you go to vote in your state and you get down to like, you know, city commissioner, county sheriff, prosecuting attorney, water district, right? You get down to these low level races and these are just names on a ballot to you. They don't mean jack. You don't know these people. You have no idea what they stand for. You don't have no idea. You might see a Republican or a Democrat behind their name or a Green or a Lib or whatever it might be. But besides that, you don't know what their positions are, what they stand for, what their experience is, unless you went and took the time beforehand to, you know, look up on some website who's going to be running and then go to every website for those people and try to find out what they stand for, at least for those that have websites. Some of them don't. Well, here in Oregon, they mail it to you. You get a book. You get a book mailed to you with every candidate's name, their background, their own statements as far as what they stand for. Every ballot initiative and tax levy and fee hike and everything we vote on has a summary statement, has arguments for it, arguments against it. And you get this weeks in advance. You get it weeks in advance and you can look over it and you can write in it and highlight, oh, I'm going to vote for this guy. Oh, this X, don't get, oh, that's bad, right? You can mark it up. And then eventually you get your ballot mailed to you. I think it's like 3 weeks before the election or something like that. You get your ballot mailed to you. It's one of them little bubble sheet kind of things. You fill in the oval. You can go back to your highlighted book and read through and go, oh, yeah, that guy. Oh, yeah, that ballot. Oh, yeah, that initiative, right? And mark up your ballot, put it in a little secrecy envelope, sign the outside of that, put that in another envelope, put a stamp on it, drop it in the mail, boom, you voted. And you made informed decisions, even down to these low-level races and obscure county bond and school bond elections. You made informed decisions, or at least you had the opportunity to make those informed decisions. This is what needs to happen on a nationwide level. You know, I've gotten some heat because I'm kind of, you know, I've gotten a lot of reads on my Bernie or Bust posts on Huffington Post. And I've been salivating at this idea of the Bernie and Trump debate. That would be legendary. Now Trump's chickening out, I hear. A couple of tech companies put up the $10 or $20 million that he was demanding for charity. And they called his bluff. Okay, yeah, well, $20 million, sure, let's do it. And so, no, I'm backing out because it wouldn't be seemly to debate the second place finisher, you know, because Trump's all about, you know, the way thing, you know, the appearances must matter to him, right? So, wouldn't be seemly, sure, right? No, it's because he'd get his ass kicked in a debate. That's why. But this this debate and this election cycle overall has just gotten me worried about this, because one of the reasons I've got this Bernie or Bust stance is because of all the problems we have in this country, none of them can't make meaningful movement on any of them without reforming the corruption of our system, without addressing the oligarchic and plutocratic nature of the system itself. I'm reminded of that brilliant editorial cartoon that's out. It's the Titanic. And on the back of the Titanic is Donald Trump pointing at the water saying, there are a lot of sharks in that water. We got to kill them all. In the middle of the Titanic, up at the on the deck is Hillary Clinton saying, I know how to best pilot a ship. And on the front of the Titanic is Bernie pointing, saying, iceberg. And that's how it feels now. That's how it feels. And I get so tired of the scare tactic. Oh, what if President Trump? What if there's a President Trump and he's nominating the Supreme Court justices and he appoints Chris Christie as the Attorney General? Yeah, whatever. And yeah, those would be some pretty horrifying things to have happen. But would they be any more horrifying than the next Middle East war that Hillary Clinton gets us into and gets a bunch of young people killed in, creates more terrorist enemies abroad? Would it be any worse than her putting the Wall Street back in charge of the Treasury and allowing the bankers to roam free and remain too big to fail, bigger than they were the first time they failed and brought down the economy, leading to a big market collapse that this time can't be blamed on a Bush, leading perhaps to somebody who would make Trump even look preferable in the next election? Could it be any worse than her continuing to promote fracking worldwide, continuing to pump methane into the atmosphere from the leaks from the fracking, tap water being set afire? Could it be any worse than her imperial point of view revealed so tellingly this week by the Inspector General's report that she just couldn't be bothered to follow the very rules she had set for email at the Department of State, having been shown and called out on MSNBC of all channels by Andrea Mitchell of all people, being called out as being a rank liar for the past few months about this situation. It's like I always point back to that, you know, and people think it's this little thing, and I think it's so telling when you look at Hillary Clinton, that one time when she said she had to duck sniper fire in Bosnia, that to me distilled her character to me, because not only did she lie about that to be self-aggrandizing about how, you know, she's suffering the military, you know, like our soldiers do, but then when she was caught in the lie by videotaped evidence, she spun more lies about it. Saying, oh, well, I had to stop to see the little girl, but then I had to keep going. And even that wasn't true because she stopped and lingered with a whole bunch of people. That, to me, distills it for me.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
That's me if you're asking me to vote for Hillary Clinton to stop Trump. I'm sorry, Dave. I just can't do that. Michael in our chat room says, if the Dems keep going with Clinton, it will be a President Trump. I agree. The only way Trump can win is if the Democrats nominate the only candidate he can possibly beat. All right, when we come back, police and pot from the Normal Conference. Stick around.
Maui Wowie. Acapulco Gold. California Kush. Our strains stretch everywhere, too.
This is the Cannabis Radio Network.
Gondrepreneur.com, your guide to the cannabis business world. Gondrepreneur.com is a comprehensive resource for cannabis professionals and entrepreneurs. Download the Gondrepreneur app on your smartphone or tablet to catch up on cannabis industry news, scroll through our daily job listings, and learn about successful cannabis companies, executives, and investors. Gondrepreneur.com, helping gondrepreneurs grow.
It's time for cannabis facts about Alzheimer's from Robert Platschorn's thesilvertour.org. This message is supported by our donors and Hemp Inc., a public company poised to lead America's hemp revolution at hempinc.com. A new Florida study in the journal Molecular and Cellular Neuroscience found that cannabis promotes the growth of healthy new brain tissue. It can slow the effects of Alzheimer's and may, in fact, be able to halt it entirely. A long-term study by Ohio State University's Professor Gary Wenk concludes that people who regularly use marijuana get Alzheimer's at a much lower rate than others. This was Cannabis Facts from thesilvertour.org, an educational nonprofit supported by our donors and Hemp Inc., a public company poised to lead America's hemp revolution at hempinc.com.
The Russ Belville Show, providing dictionaries to drug czars since 2009.
Hey everybody, it's Radical Russ here from 420 Radio, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
And blue blasting gurgan, fuffin' der blasting schnurb norbin. You're tuned into the Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation, only on CannabisRadio.com.
Welcome back, everybody. We return you to the normal conference that took place Monday in Washington, D.C. A great panel on police and pot that features Chris Goldstein from Philly Normal, Dr. Harry Levine from Queens College, Dr. John Getman, who was a normal director and now is with Shenandoah University, and Lauren Siegel, who heads up the MarijuanaArrests.com website. Some illuminating statistics and information from some well-informed panelists. Enjoy.
Today, this afternoon, we really have a quite incredible panel here today. Everyone you're going to hear from today has been researching the marijuana arrest problem in the United States for several decades. You know, the police and authorities have never been really proud of how many marijuana arrests there are. 600,000, 700,000, 800,000. You know, in the 1990s, I used to look at arrest reports, and the DEA and the federal government, they would be proud of how much marijuana they seized. They'd be gleaming about the pounds of pot. But when it came to the arrests, they didn't have the same pride that they did for other crimes out there. But they also didn't release much data. They didn't tell you where people were arrested, how old they are, what their gender or their race is. It wasn't until advocates within Normal and within the marijuana reform community started doing the hard analysis of this crime information that we started to get a handle on how many cannabis consumers were suffering under prohibition every year. And you might take it for granted, you know, when you see that number come out from National Normal, Paul will put out a press release. The FBI Uniform Crime Report says 800,000 people were arrested. Well, even in there, when you open the Uniform Crime Report, there's no number that says that. It says there were X amount of drug arrests and 24.68% were for marijuana. And you've got to sit there and do the math yourself. So what I'm getting here is that we have John Getman's here today. He's a former director of National Normal. He has been researching not only marijuana arrest information over the years, but he has done the hard research to project the economic impact of prohibition on states and the country and how we can move away from that. Also with us today is Lauren Siegel and Harry Levine. They co-founded the Marijuana Arrest Project to analyze arrest data. Harry is at the City University of New York, Queens College, and it was his landmark analysis of New York City's marijuana arrests. And then going further, because Harry actually, he didn't just look at the data. He actually went out and talked to the cops and tried to figure out like why so many people were getting arrested in New York City and why the racial disparity is where it is today. So all of our panelists today brought you what many of us can, you know, when you hear those numbers about arrests, when you hear that there's a racial disparity to prohibition, this is a given today. This is a major part of our movement towards changing these laws. This is what motivates politicians. I've seen it in Pennsylvania and in Philadelphia. They want to solve these problems. But again, we didn't get here for no reason. This data isn't easy. It takes hard work, often years of work, often filing open public records acts and FOIA requests and digging through state data to come up with these numbers. So we're going to start out today, and this is fascinating stuff because at the end of the day, it's not just numbers. Every one of these numbers, when you talk about arrests, is a cannabis consumer, somebody who doesn't deserve to be put into handcuffs, somebody who should be living a free life with great liberty in this country, not be stepped on by the state. So I'm going to start with John. We're going to move to Lauren and Harry, and then I'll clean up a little bit. Oh, I'm sorry. That's right. We changed the order. We're starting with Harry. Then we're going to have John. Then we're going to have Lauren. I think I got it right. All right. So we'll start with Harry Levine, City University of New York. Harry, welcome.
Hello. Can you hear me? No. My voice is pretty loud. Maybe you don't need, let's say recording this or something.
Yeah.
They are. What a shame. All right. My name is Harry Levine. If you Google my name, it's the first Harry Levine that comes up. my academic website. With Lauren Siegel over there. We run a thing called the Marijuana Arrest Research Project. If you Google marijuana arrests, that website comes up. And all we can do is talk about a little bit today. There's lots more stuff on the website. Anybody here been arrested? How many people here have been arrested? Wow, good for you. Good for you. People arrested for possessing marijuana or for marijuana. Nice work. Okay. Unusual for white people. Very nice. I put some things on the table. One of them is a graph of the marijuana arrests. From 95 to 2010, Normal has a more complete one on its website. But the climbing arrests, they've tapered off, they've leveled off a little bit because of Colorado, Washington, and now Oregon and Alaska. But in some places, and John Getman reports that in Virginia, for example, they're continuing to rise over the last five, six, 7 years. and lots of places they are as well. Everywhere in America, and this is from this amazing report by the ACLU, which is exists on a PDF form you can find on the web and download. Everywhere in America, blacks and Latinos, but blacks from the FBI data are arrested at 3, 5, 7, 10 times the rate of whites. Everywhere in America, in every major city, in every major county, in every state in America. It is a major, scandalous racial justice question of immense proportion. Some as part of sort of the war on drugs, people call it the new civil rights movement. But the other thing to understand, and it's taken a while for people to grasp it, but it's happened, is that it is perhaps the issue of racial justice and the marijuana arrest is perhaps one of the most powerful weapons for marijuana reform and marijuana legalization that has happened in the last 20 years. The case for reforming marijuana, decriminalizing marijuana, and especially for ending marijuana prohibition can rest on a whole variety of things having to do with tax revenue, sensibility, freedom, economic development, industry. And those things by themselves may carry voters, but they don't carry legislators. And they don't carry elected officials. Not nearly enough. In America, unless something has a moral, ethical component to it, it is hard to sell it to politicians. It has to be naked, fierce self-interest, or some kind of political and ethical one. And the scandal of marijuana arrests, the stone cold racism of them, the 1950s segregation character of these things, digs into the heart, if they know about it, of timid, spineless, gutless liberals and even moderate conservatives. They look in the mirror and they say, I want to legalize marijuana because it's a racial justice issue. Not because it's going to make good tax revenue. Not because it's going to do this. Not because it's going to that. Because it's fair and right. Because it's a civil rights issue. And as a civil rights issue, it has moved an amazing number of politicians already, including a number of congressmen, senators, elected officials, various parts of the United States, including people who've shown no evidence of ever having consciences before. Rahm Emanuel, Andrew Cuomo, and more. So I, as lobbyists, as potential lobbyists, as people who speak on this issue, I urge you to include in your arsenal of material, in fact, put it up at the front of the things you talk about to elected officials everywhere, anywhere, is to talk about the stone-cold racial injustice of the marijuana arrest. Now, it's easy to say. We got a slide. This is on the web at our website, Marijuana Arrest. I'll just show you a couple of things right now. This is what the ACLU says. Targets communities of color. Blacks, on average, are more time. $3.6 billion a year spent, if you care about money. Marijuana, the finding number one of the ACE, this 200-page book-length report. Marijuana arrests count for over half of drug arrests. There's the same graph you just saw. Racial disparities across the United States, they've increased in recent years. There's a graph of the white rate and the black rate. It's stunning. There's the arrest rates, the same one you've got on your tables right now. The year after year after year, you can do this for every state, you can do this for every major city. But with Chris, John, Lauren, and I, you have four of the people who have done more about this than anybody, and this kind of graph exists everywhere. By region, doesn't really matter much. Big cities, everywhere. Age, majority of people 25 and under, 70% of them are 30 and under. You know, you get close to nearly 80% are 35 and under. There's young people being targeted, again, disproportionately, blacks and Latinos. White people use marijuana more than black people. Young white people, the people who are getting arrested, young people, young whites use marijuana more than blacks and more than Latinos. Absolute, stone-cold, incontrovertible fact, United States government studies year after year after year after year after year. Young whites use marijuana more than blacks and Latinos. When you put in the old people, it evens out because there are a lot more old white people. Cost an immense amount of money, you already know that. Some states, more blacks, more marijuana arrests. And the ACLU says to stop this, you gotta legalize the stuff. Period. End of story. We have a piece that talks about some of this stuff that was in The Nation a couple of years ago. I put copies of it on the table. We have another one here. We have another handout which we should give out to you. The thing to understand, and I guess I didn't talk about it, but it's a shame, but is why the police do this. The single largest enemy and opponent of marijuana reform in the United States is law enforcement. It's not religious groups. It is not parents groups. It's not anti-drug groups. It's not competing businesses to the marijuana business. It's police. It's police and prosecutors. It's police departments. It's sheriff's departments. They're allies in prison guard units. And they like the marijuana arrests because they're good business. They have quotas. The cops have quotas to make. The ordinary cops like the quotas. They're safe arrests. They're easy arrests. Marijuana possessors are not violent. They're not going to mess with somebody by and large. They go along peacefully. Unlike most of the people that the cops have to arrest, they are clean, meaning physically clean. They don't have HIV. They don't have AIDS. They don't have hepatitis. They don't have TB, mostly. Unlike drunks and junkies, they don't throw up on the officer or in the squad car. When a cop arrests somebody, they are physically married to them, is the expression that's used. The arresting officer takes the fingerprints and photographs. They have to touch them and so on. Marijuana users are very highly desirable arrestees. They have to spend several hours with them. They have to sit in the police station with them. They may accompany them to court. The supervisors of cops like the marijuana arrests. Oh, then they get overtime, by the way. Make an arrest toward the end of a shift, and you can get 3 or 4 hours of time and a half overtime. In New York City, this is so well known that for years it is called, anybody know that expression? Collars for dollars. Collars for dollars. Making arrests toward the end of your shift is collars for dollars. In New York City, in Chicago, the most common form of arrest has been marijuana arrests. That's true in many police departments across the United States. Big business. Supervisors like the marijuana arrests. Why do supervisors like the marijuana arrests? The number one question facing a police supervisor at every single level, desk sergeant, lieutenant, squad commander, captain, whatever, is where the hell are my cops right now and what are they doing? And if they are doing low-level enforcement, if they're writing summonses of various kinds, and especially if they're making arrests, then you know where they are. They're generating paperwork. They're bringing somebody in. You have a record of where they have and what they've done. So the supervisors knows what the cop is doing. The chain, it goes up the chain of command all the way up to the top. Cops make overtime for making the arrest. The supervisors of the officers who get the overtime, they get overtime. not everywhere, but in Chicago and New York they do. There's a push that starts at the federal government. It goes to state, goes to counties, goes to local police departments to get as many people as possible into the system, meaning getting fingerprints and photographs on them. There is nothing that police departments can do that gets as many new people into the system as the big net of marijuana arrests, especially young people of color. Training cops. 6 months of police academy, they put them out on the street, they know the law. Whenever somebody says cops don't know the law, it's bullshit. They absolutely know the law. They just disregard it. But they don't know how to talk to people. They don't know how to interact. And many police, new police, come from ex-urban areas, rural areas, outside suburban areas. They're not from cities. They're not they're often even not familiar with talking to black people, and they've maybe never had any conversation with Latinos. So what do you do with these cops? Well, what they do, and all police departments do it, and to some of your big city police departments and smaller city departments, they put them in a group, they send them out to police to a local neighborhood, and they have them write summonses, do stop and frisks, and make low-level bullshit arrests. If they do, they get to touch people a lot, they have to talk to young teenagers like their same age as themselves a bunch. They have to learn the dialect. They have to get somewhat savvy at doing this so they don't get people pissed at them. They do this every day for a year, and they sort of become cops. The psychopaths wash out. Some of them discover they hate it. They sort of learn. And if they screw up, if they mess up the paperwork, it's just a marijuana arrest. Nobody cares. So the police and the law enforcement community are the major opponents of drug policy reform, of marijuana policy reform, of marijuana reform, including legalization, including decriminalization, including medical marijuana. They don't like any of it. There are some who, in this case, in Washington State, they got a number of police to be involved in and support the referendum, the ballot measure there in 2012. But that's not going to happen in most places. They may step aside, but it's hard. So when you go onto Capitol Hill and when you go talk to people, talk about the racist marijuana arrests in America and tell those politicians that they need to stop these damn things now.
Okay, I have a slideshow. How do I get to it? Ably so. Thank you. Hi there. Before I get into this, I have just a few acknowledgments I'd like to make, which have to do with why this subject has really started to get attention. And at the front end of this, how I got into this data, well, first of all, I need to acknowledge how valuable it's been to, and how important it is to me to be a member of Normal's community, to have been working with this group for a long time and been influenced by it. And second of all, Normal gave out an award before lunch to the Michael J. Kennedy Award for Social Justice. And if it weren't for Michael Kennedy was an integral part and an avid supporter of my work over the years. And frankly, because of Michael Kennedy, I was able to go get a PhD. And his support helped me complete my doctoral studies. What I learned there, just some basic skills about working with data. My first big project getting out of that was looking at marijuana arrests by race. And I did several reports on this topic. Normal helped publicize some of the early reports. And now we get to the back end of this. I was making a mistake back then, a mistake that a lot of college students make. Now that I'm a professor, I kind of warn them about it. It's called the data dump. And I would pull together all this information and release it and then be disappointed that it didn't quite get the attention that I thought it deserved. But it got the attention of one guy, and that was Harry Levine. And Harry began to look into this issue in more detail. And after a while, he and Lauren and I started working together. And it's Harry who was the evangelist, if you will, who went out and started talking to more and more people and more groups and saying, look, this is important information. We got to pay attention to this. And eventually, Harry had a very interesting conversation over a period of time with the ACLU. And he brought my data to them, got them in touch with me. I gave them the whole, here's the data dump, take it all. And that produced the ACLU report. And while I'm very proud of my data getting some attention, I'm especially grateful to Harry and Lauren for getting it attention and help making this such a widely recognized problem in our justice system today. So please join me in applauding them for their help and support for this. All right, now, one of the things they taught me was... No data dump. Be focused. Keep it simple. Make it, you know, something people can grasp on. So I got a very simple little topic for you today, right now. And that's what happens to the racial disparities in marijuana arrests when the arrests are really supposed to be winding down, when they're supposed to stop. What happens when we have significant reform? And so for this short little presentation, I'm going to compare five states. And obviously Colorado, I'm sorry, I'm used to school where, you know, so test case, Virginia, no reform. Now, we have a reasonable marijuana possession offense penalty in Virginia. It's 0 to 30 days and a $500 fine, but that doesn't keep them from making arrests, which I'll show you. And then Massachusetts and California. Now, people think, oh, California, decrim state for a long time. Well, actually, as Harry has argued for years, no, it was still a criminal offense. They just wrote a court summons instead of making a custodial arrest. It's only in the last few years they changed it to what is known as a civil infraction, more like a parking ticket. And that's also what took place in Massachusetts. And of course, we have Colorado and Washington, where really, to be honest, personal use quantities have been legalized as well as some commercial trade. And just to cut to the chase here, significant reforms in marijuana laws reduce arrest rates. They stop making as many arrests, absolutely. But it has no effect on the, well, not no effect, but the racial disparities in arrest remain. So changes in laws regarding the criminal status of personal use possession will reduce arrest rates for whites and blacks, but arrest rates for blacks remain significantly higher than for whites. And changes in laws about personal possession have little impact on arrest rates for marijuana sales and no impact on racial disparities in arrest rates for marijuana sales. Now, we're working with Uniform Crime Reporting Program data and U.S. Census data. And now we're going to see the same graph for five states, one for possession, one for sales. So in this graph, the I'm not using the Harry colors. Harry has this great color scheme of pink bars for white arrest rates and black bars for black arrest rates. And I was just wanted to be different for a change. So anyway, white rate is the green bar. Black rate is the blue bar. And as you see over the last several years, the arrest rate for whites in Virginia for possession, came down for a while, but it's been relatively stable. But you look at those blue bars, and the arrest rate for blacks in Virginia for possession going up through 2014, the last year I have UCR data for, it's just climbing. Okay, down a little bit in 14 over 13, still significantly high. And if you look at the actual raw numbers, in 2013, the entire increase in marijuana arrests in Virginia were black arrests. They're arresting more black folks every year. And the same thing holds for sales. Same trend. And you can really see the racial disparity issue by looking now at sales data, particularly, and we're going to do this with the reform states. It's a little bit stronger of a disparity. And the same thing, there's a continuity when it comes to the arrest rate for whites And with blacks, really starting from, I guess, the year 2000, it's a steady increase. Now, we as a group of advocates have stayed away from looking at sales arrests over time because our biggest argument has been that individuals who use marijuana aren't really breaking laws, that is, you know, things that are inherently bad. And there's not as much public sympathy for people who are trying to make money off selling drugs. The reason why we need to look at sales more is the issue today is not sympathy for the individual drug seller, although there are outrageous cases there. But it's the legal market versus the illegal market. And the data on sales arrests demonstrates that you can arrest 80,000, 90,000 people a year, which is pretty much what's going on these days. We still have an illegal market. And if you don't like legalization, you're saying, I prefer the illegal market. I prefer to outsource public policy objectives of reducing popular use of marijuana by keeping it criminal and letting criminals control the market. So the sales data is important for a lot of reasons. But here we have, I don't know if Virginia is a typical state, but in 2012, there were 17 states in which, in the previous 5 years, marijuana arrests, on average, went up every year. Now, Massachusetts. Hey, guess when the law was changed? Big change there. And in fact, arrests in 2014 have really finally dropped. There have been like a couple thousand arrests per year in the last couple years in Massachusetts. Now, in 14, it was finally dropped to like 500. They're finally getting the message and ending arrests. But see, not every marijuana possession offense has been reformed, decriminalized, in the other states legalized, that there are certain thresholds. So in Massachusetts, with the civil infraction change, yeah, a big drop in the number of arrests, but there's still a disparity. That blue bar is still bigger than that white bar. And it may be lower arrests, and certainly less black folks, less African Americans are getting arrested than before, as less whites are getting arrested before, but still more blacks than whites when you get to arrest rates. And without in an area of arrest where there's no reform in sales, again, tremendous racial disparity. Now, this does have to do with where the police are more aggressively doing enforcement activity, but that's not necessarily always neighborhood policing, broken windows philosophy of policing. That's also driving while black. There's also different types of enforcement activity that tend to target areas or create circumstances in which blacks are arrested at a greater rate than whites. Okay, so Massachusetts, by the way, in many respects thought of as being a fairly liberal state, certainly referred to as a blue state in the popular dichotomy, and the same thing goes for California. Now, again, a decrim state, but a court summons until 2011, when they were so freaked out about the prospect of legalization, they made it a civil infraction. Now, again, the racial disparity there is strong before that change. It is not as great. Some credit to California. The disparity is not as great in these last 4 years, but it's still there. And by the way, lest you think this is, oh, Southern California, more conservative California, there's one point where I got the data for San Francisco. By the way, California. Great data. They keep data. I feel like Donald Trump. I shouldn't do that. The summonses in the city of San Francisco still demonstrated the racial disparity you see throughout the state. It's not a Southern California phenomenon. It's a statewide phenomenon. So again, once again, same pattern as in Massachusetts. Significant reform, racial disparity persists. And when it comes to sales, still there. Now, the number of the arrest rate has been dropping for African Americans, been dropping not as dramatically for whites, but same trend. So what do you think we're going to see with Colorado and Washington? I already told you, and it's the same thing. Now, with Colorado, I did a report for the Drug Policy Alliance about a year ago, looking at the first data from 2013. And we're looking at data that the Colorado Bureau of Investigation supplied us. And I got to get a little wonky for a second. This is all UCR data, Uniform Crime Reporting Program. There's a new arrest reporting program called NIBRS. I call it NIBRS, but I think that's a personal eccentricity. It's the National Incident-Based Reporting System, and it provides a lot more data about each incident in which an arrest is made. It gives more detailed data on the drugs, such as the amount of the drug that's being seized. And the Colorado report on legalization that came out about a month or two ago, they had NIBRS data. And they had the same findings there that I reported in the DPA report. Arrests are down, racial disparities persist. The reason I give you this little wonky background, the NIBRS data reports a higher number of arrests for possession than the UCR data. I haven't quite tracked that down yet, but on absolute numbers, the UCR data, for example, for 2014, is about 5,000 possession arrests in Colorado. I think the NIBRS data in the Colorado reports like 7,000 arrests. So the absolute counts are off. But what's important is the trends remain the same. And it's interesting that legalization in Colorado has had an effect on the number of arrests. And you can see how the arrest rates are significantly down in 2013, 2014. But they're not down by much. Now, again, Colorado, decrim state before legalization, and you see a dropping trend with the black arrest rate. That's good. You see kind of a stable arrest rate for whites, the green bars. But still, the change after legalization is lower arrests, racial disparities persist. And oh gosh, they still make arrests for marijuana sales in Colorado. And again, familiar trends here.
We got to cut it off there here because we're out of time. But that was John Getman, the former director of NORML, describing the before and after in racial disparities, before and after legalization or decriminalization. Before him, you heard Dr. Harry Levine from Queens College, who's one of the leading experts on the racial disparity in marijuana policing. The full panel will be available on my SoundCloud page later tonight, and I'll tweet out those links and share them on Facebook as well. Stay tuned because Stoner Jesus is coming up next live here on Cannabis Radio. For everyone here, I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us from beautiful Legal Potland, Oregon. We'll talk to you Tuesday from Phoenix. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.
This is the Russ Belville Show. The Russ Belville Show is blogging and podcasting daily at RadicalRuss.com. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth.